This is not supposed to be a formal talk. This is more like a discussion. So let me tell you what's the plan. I intend to give you a brief talk, like 30-something minutes. Allow me to briefly introduce the subject that we're going to discuss, which is the dielectric cosmography. And then basically I'm going to tell you about an experiment that I participated. It was done on graphite. I'm going to tell you about this conversion between graphite and graphene business. Okay. Then I'm going to show you some data. And then I'm going to tell you what we did with this data. And then I'm going to comment on some other experiments. Okay. And then we can start discussing. Okay. So this is not intended to be formal. Okay. So first of all, the whole story here is related to the strength of interactions in graphene. And that's an important question, right? The RG calculations that Maria, Paco, and others did assume is a perturbative calculation. And the parameter of this calculation is basically alpha, which is a dimensionless parameter, which you can just compute by taking the ratio of the Coulomb energy divided by the kinetic energy, okay? And just because this is a linear spectrum in 2D system, this is a dimensionless number. So this number, it turns out, is not like in QED, it's not 1 over 137. It's actually of the order of 2, so this is not small. Okay. So you may ask yourself what polarization effects can do.
In principle,
they could be very significant, right? So this is the RG calculation that Paco, Maria, and Gonzalez did a long time ago. So the important feature of this calculation is that there is a log in the renormalization of the spectrum, okay? And this log does not resum, so if you go to higher order, you don't get leading log square or log cube terms. So we cannot resum these logs, so it should be observable in the experiments that can see the self-energy.
You can interrupt, right?
You can interrupt, please.
But there are more logs in higher orders, right? The log squares and so on. Because we can.
You did not compute logs, right? Did you?
Can you comment? So in third loops, there are log squares and so on, right? It's not a single log square.
Is it forbidden, Oscar? Is it forbidden to have alpha cube log square? Or no?
No.
It will not be sum, so I agree with the
Yeah.
But he's also right.
He could, right?
Even high order logs.
Right.
But they be sum in a different way.
Right, but they're subleading in this sense. Okay.
But there are things like alpha cube log squared, for sure, right?
I think you could, right?
I think
that nobody computes.
But they don't resum, like
this is an open question that perhaps is not interesting.
No. Yeah, so this is a side question.
I have a more important question. Is this recorded?
Yes, it's being recorded.
Okay.
Maybe we can turn it off. So the physical idea here is to figure out how polarizable graphene is, right? Although it's a two-dimensional system, the polarization in the spectrum, the fact the spectrum is linear, allows you, in principle, to have a dielectric constant. So this is not forbidden, as it would be in an insulator, right? Basically, where the gap would give you a crossover length scale, where basically the dielectric constant would go to 1, like in vacuum, right? And of course, it's clear that if you have a log, alpha will eventually run to 0. So no matter what happens, you will eventually reach the state where there are no interactions. So the question is, what is the value of alpha that you will put in your RG? Right? What is the initial value of alpha in your RG? Is it small or is it large? Right? If it's small, then it's going to be, you have to get, yes?
Can I just make a little bit of clarification? So I would agree with you, but not completely. Mm-hmm. I would say that this is true for a finite window of alpha. If alpha exceeds some critical value, it will not fall back to 0.
This is true. This is true. There's these calculations of sun which assume large n. And in large n, in a sense, it's like cheating, right? Because you won't get the instability, right? Because you're on the wrong side of the Gross-Novo phase diagram.
Yeah, because my very for short range, yes, to comment on the comment. With short range interactions. I haven't seen any reliable calculation of Monte Carlo or anything with long range Coulomb interaction.
But would you believe, just based on physical grounds, that the alpha is 10,000?
No.
This is
the only thing I say is there is no calculation. backing up this alpha critical for long-range Coulomb dipoles.
No, but this is just physics. If you have alpha, which dominates, and you can't get energy.
It's not only alpha, it's also n. You screen
alpha. Yeah, well, it's physical n. But then would you agree that when alpha is very, very large,
no,
that your system goes into an insulator?
For QED and things like that, it's not alpha again, it's n, because you have alpha divided by 1 over n times alpha.
N is 4 or 2, whatever.
Okay.
Fix that. Take alpha to be very large.
Okay,
would you agree that the system is an insulator, very large alpha?
Actually, I think it may happen that the critical n is less than 4, that's what I'm trying to say. And in that case, for no alpha, it would be okay.
It is less than 4 in QED3. So, I mean, the only thing that we know in long range is QED3, which is not for thing, you know? And there, the critical n is like 1.5. Whatever.
Okay.
So it may happen that you never have
this. Okay, so
I think.
So I think there's another topic we can discuss. If there is a critical alpha, you should expect on physical grounds to have a critical alpha. Okay. So now let's try to address the problem of the vacuum polarization. So if there is a number, what is that number? Right. So vacuum polarization is basically processes where excite holes up to the upper band, and that process, those processes, in these guys decay back into the vacuum, and basically polarize charge. Right, and if alpha is 2.2 in a certain range of momentum, where the logs are not that important, then the system can be strongly polarized. So the question is, if there is a way you can compute pi, the polarization, and get the epsilon, right, that will give you directly the dielectric function. But the problem, I'll get back to this. But the problem is, if alpha is 2.2. Right, and you start computing diagrams. Let's say the first one that will contribute to the dielectric function, right? It's this one here. And when alpha is 2.2, you get a number which is almost of the same order of the leading one. So this is a completely uncontrollable approximation, right? You have no right to stop there. You have to keep going to all orders in principle. Yes.
I'm just asking an outside question. It may be ridiculous, but if you have a coupling constant that's strong, mm-hmm. and you try to polarize it, mm-hmm. what would happen in a standard relativistic theory like QED is you just simply get dielectric breakdown of the vacuum, and essentially you're going to start producing you'll start producing virtual electron positron pairs, which will just you don't have the standard vacuum of the theory once you start polarizing it. It should look completely different.
My claim is we don't know what happens. Clearly, for an experiment, nothing striking happens in the sense that probably just gives you dielectric screening or not. Right? There's no reconstruction of the vacuum. Nobody has measured anything strange happening in graphene.
Then another question is, I guess the speed of photons or effective electromagnetic waves mm-hmm. is different from electrons. Mm-hmm. Is there still some relationship between the dielectric constant, the permittivity and the permeability, where the product of them is given by some nice relational, so there's some other functional form, because then this would be related also to the response to a magnetic field.
Right. The fact that the electrons are much slower than the speed of light, in a sense, changes the form of world identities. So I didn't put here, but these two diagrams here, so the Coulomb interaction is basically 1 over Q. And in these two diagrams here, this and this, they do not cancel each other. This one has a log, which is basically feeds the renormalization of the velocity, but this one doesn't.
But I have to argue about that. This is cancelled by the self-energy renormalization. Sorry, no, this log is cancelled by another diagram that you forgot to put, which is that one. And this comes from the counter term that you add when you have to cancel this log. So this is no problem. This is finite.
Sure, sure. This is not a problem of the theory. This is not a problem of the theory. Okay. It's just a different way of saying it. Okay. Yes.
So here, alpha is a function of Q or omega or just number.
It's just a number.
Yeah. So, but in previous slides, you showed us that this alpha depends on VF, and the VF is basically.
Oh no! There, I was showing you epsilon, which is Coulomb interaction times pi. So pi is, this guy here is linear in Q, but the Coulomb interaction is 1 over Q. Sorry. So this guy here is linear in Q, but this guy is 1 over Q. So this gives you a constant.
My question is there a VF? I mean, did you set VF?
The way the pi is. Alpha is E square over V.
Upstairs, that's
the band.
Right, so V is going to be
here. Here.
Right, so okay. V is increasing basically.
Yes, yes. Yes, yes.
And then it becomes, V is functional Q basically.
Sure, but that's the point. Eventually, these velocities will run, right? And then alpha going to zero. So I'm talking in the regime where these logs are not important yet. So in a sense, what I'm discussing was what is the initial value of alpha in your RG flow, right? So if the number that goes in front of the log is small, it means it's gonna you're gonna have to get very close to the Dirac point in order to see these logs. That's all I'm saying.
Right. Can you set Q to some constant?
That it will run. I have no question that it will. The question is how close you have to get to the Dirac point to see it. So I'm going to tell you about one experiment that we did to try to address this question. In other words, how polarizable is the vacuum of graphene? And that was done with X-ray experiments with Peter Abamonte in Urbana-Champaign. Okay. So in principle, this is the perfect experiment to measure density-density correlation functions. The problem of X-rays in graphene is that is basically that you cannot really do X-rays in a single layer material. Because X-rays penetrates microns, so the scattering cross-section is ridiculously small. You won't get any signal out of that. Okay. So in order to do something with this, one idea was to try to do the experiment on graphite and see if it's possible to get some useful information for a freestanding single layer. The question is if that's possible. And my point is I'm going to try to convince you that you can extract meaningful information in spite of the several differences that the two systems have, okay? So in principle, this is not obvious, right? Because, graphite is an infinite number of layers which are coupled by Coulomb interaction, okay? The dimensionality of the Coulomb interaction is different. In graphite, it's 1 over Q squared, and graphene is 1 over Q. You have electronic hopping between the layers in graphite, okay? Which makes the bands not Dirac cones, but parabolic, okay? So there are many things which are different. So the question is, can you do an experiment on graphite and extract meaningful information about the properties of the vacuum of a single freestanding layer, right? So I'm going to show you that, in principle, that this is possible, that one can.
What's the electric cost of the graphite?
As you approach the K or H points, it's infinite, right? Because the Coulomb interaction is 1 over Q squared. Let's say that you are in the region where pi is linear, right? This is like epsilon 1 over Q squared times Q, right?
Pi of graphite is the same as pi of
graphene? Well, in a region where the spectrum is linear, it's the same. But at some point, when you reach T perp, it becomes parabolic. So you get a finite density of states. Then it goes like a constant 1 over Q squared. Then it diverges. That's my point. Like a number? That's wrong.
It's a metal.
It diverges.
Right.
Okay. I know it's confusing because if you look in the literature and we have, you see people saying 2, 6, right? And that's a misconception because it's a metal. Okay.
Frequency. Yeah, finite frequency is fine, right? It's just zero frequency.
Yeah, this is zero frequency. Okay. So here's the argument to say why you can extract useful information from graphite and say something about a single graphene layer. So this is the argument. So let's say for now, okay, the T perp, which is electronic hopping, is zero. I will tell you about when it's not. Okay. So for now, let's say that T perp is zero. So if T perp is zero, do you have a pointer? No. So if T perp is zero, then it means that the electrons. Okay, thank you. Okay, so so this is the argument, Leonid, to say basically why you can extract useful information for graphene, a single freestanding graphene layer, out of graphite, basically relating the susceptibilities of these two systems. Okay, so the argument here is that let's say for now the T perp is zero. So if T perp is zero, so that means the electrons do not disperse along the C-axis direction. Okay, if that's true, when T perp is zero, which it is, then basically these propagators of fermions do not have KZ dependence. So the only place where KZ appears is in the wavy line of the Coulomb interaction, for example, in this guy here, right? Because Coulomb interaction is one over Q square. But then you have to integrate in KZ, right? Because that's the only place where KZ appears, and then you get 1 over Q. So my point, and you can repeat this argument for any order in perturbation theory. So my point is that as far as T perp is zero, in other words, the single particle spectrum of graphite and graphene are identical, the polarization functions of graphite and graphene should be the same. That's an exact statement. Okay? Why? Why?
There should be relations between the
layers. Right, right. But my When the hopping is zero, they should be identical, provided they have
up-to-image charges.
What?
Up-to-image charges.
I'm considering all Coulomb interactions between everybody. There's no transfer of charge, but they're coupled.
But there are image charges.
Everything is taken into account.
Right.
So my argument is that if T perp is zero, which is not true, then they have if they have the same single particle spectrum, then basically you can't, the polarization functions of the two are identical to all orders in perturbation theory. And the argument is that this is a proof, right, for when T perp is zero. And the proof is that if T perp is zero, the Green's function of the electrons do not disperse along the C-axis direction, right? They have no KZ dependence because T perp is zero. Therefore, the only place where KZ appears is in the Coulomb interaction, which is 1 over Q squared. I mean, K squared, right? Q squared plus KZ squared. But KZ only appears in this guy here, for example. So you have to integrate this guy. And when you do, you get 1 over Q, right? So it doesn't. So KZ doesn't show up at all. And you can repeat the same argument for any complicated diagram you can think of.
You have bilayer, for example.
Yes.
Which is we have some interesting phases, like some correlation phases, that can open a gap without any hopping.
Yes.
No, hopping is important.
Hopping is.
But I have a different question.
Suppose you have like two linear crystals. They lock into each other in 2 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And compressibility and the polarizability will be different.
So Imagine that you have n layers.
It's not.
Imagine you have n layers, not infinite number of n layers. And you integrate n minus 1 electrons, so you have put one layer. The interactions in that layer are no longer the same as if you had just a single layer by itself.
Yeah, well, we can say that. No, but here there are two issues. One is the polarizability, and the other is the response to it.
The response function is different.
Fair enough. The response changes, but it's true that.
But polarizability is a response function.
Right? No, they're related, but it's not the same.
He's looking just to one bubble isolated from it.
I'm looking for the proper polarization. The susceptibility response is different. Okay, but the polarization, the polarizability is the same if T perp is zero. Okay, that's my argument. Okay, so my claim is that when T perp is zero, this is an exact state.
So T perp is zero, there is just a collection of one layer, right? But if you want to
It shouldn't take interaction between everybody. My claim is that the polarizability of the two is identical if there is no electronic hopping between them. So the fact that they are coupled to each other by Coulomb interaction doesn't matter at all as far as T perp is zero.
There is inter-layer Coulomb interaction.
Yes, yes. And between everybody, all
players. Yes.
So if you want to be rigorous, right, basically, you can say that for an infinite number of layers, the Coulomb interaction is not 1 over Q squared. There's a form factor, right?
And we also decrease it for.
Sure. I'm assuming there is no. Yeah, yeah. So you can prove this rigorously if you have an infinite number of layers when you have form factors.
Are you talking about RPA level?
No. This is any order of perturbation theory.
Physical level.
Why? What? Why? This is mathematical, right? Okay. My claim is that this is exact statement when T perp is zero. And you can prove this rigorously when you have an infinite number of layers, so discrete layers. Basically, it's not 1 over Q squared. It's more complicated because you have some form factors. But you get 1 over Q if you integrate the KZs, you get the same. Okay?
So here in Jacobian, only lives in the two-dimensional, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
It doesn't have the spatial uniform.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. In each plane, it's like a 2D gas.
Can I elaborate on this idea that Oscar had?
Yeah.
So suppose you have n layers,
mm-hmm.
and they're very close for the sake of argument, so mm-hmm. don't have to worry about finding spacing.
Mm-hmm.
Then effectively, it multiplies number of flavors by n, right? So instead of four flavors, you have four n flavors, right? So are we? So what's the statement that polarizability is independent of number of flavors?
This is the polarizability of not of a single layer, of an infinite stack of decoupled layers.
Yeah.
That's what it is. So okay, that's what I'm saying. This is not one layer. This is this infinite number of Coulomb decoupled layers.
An interaction inside the data.
Yes, yes.
Okay, but that interaction is the Coulomb interaction.
Yes.
So it depends on whether you have other metallic.
Right, but that's my point. Let's say you have an infinite number of layers. Now your Coulomb interaction is not 1 over Q squared. It's 1 over Q times S Q KZ, where S Q KZ is the form factor for an infinite number of layers that was computed like in the 70s. Right, so it's a complicated function. It's S, Q, KZ. I think it's sine hyperbolic of Q times D, where D is the distance between the layers, divided by cosine hyperbolic of Q times D minus cosine of KZ times D. Okay? And if you do the same procedure there, you get 1 over Q.
I checked it myself.
Can you repeat what you said earlier? That you said that layers are Coulomb decoupled. Do you mean tunnel hopping decoupled or really Coulomb decoupled?
The assumption is that they're hopping decoupled.
But Coulomb coupled.
Yeah, Coulomb coupled.
Okay.
And I'm saying that you will get the same polarizability of an infinite stack of layers which are Coulomb decoupled. Because at the end of the day, if you integrate the KZ, which doesn't appear in the fermions because there's no dispersion, you get 1 over Q, even if you take accurately the structure of the layers. Okay? And at the end of the day, it's the same thing. Okay? That's my claim. And my claim is that this is valid for all orders in perturbation theory. This is an exact statement when T perp is 0, which is not, right?
So if we take a single layer, if you take a single layer,
mm-hmm.
forget about other layers, does polarizability depend on the number of flavors?
To be fully consistent, you have to conserve the volume of the unit cell. So I'm talking about the polarizability of this infinite stack of decoupled layers. Does that answer your question or no? It's like having infinite number of single layer graphene sheets on top of each other, but completely decoupled.
But for a single graphene sheet with m equal 4 flavors. Mm-hmm. Does polarizability depend on m?
It will depend. Okay. So when you compute the polarizability, right, for infinite stack of decoupled layers, you have to integrate in kz in between pi over d and minus pi over d. So you get an overall factor of 1 over d. But the Coulomb interaction, right, which is I gave you like this, will give you the extra d factor, so they cancel out, so they don't affect the dielectric function. Okay. So basically, you get a scaling factor that scales with the distance between the layers, but the Coulomb interaction takes that into account, so they cancel.
Is this essential to the rest of, the, of your argument?
Well, can I continue? This is important. Yeah.
It's important.
Yeah, yeah, it's important.
Then we should stop here and be convinced, right? I mean, if this is essential for what follows, then
right. Or this, or we can continue and come back.
And come back. Okay.
Either way you prefer. Yeah.
So when do we start?
What?
Have we said anything yet?
Okay.
So if I consider a dynamic property, like I have omega squared here instead of q squared, omega squared plus q squared plus kdz squared, uh-huh. Dynamic property.
Right.
If omega is larger, then your argument does not hold. Because it's, instead of q, it's square root.
If you take retardation into account, I don't know. I don't know. Yes, I don't know. So can I continue, or do you want to keep discussing this point? So let me continue, then we come back.
Let's continue, because you were going to talk about this response function.
Yeah, I want to show you some data, too. So of course, t perp is not zero. So the argument of when that should work is the following. So when you compute this proper polarization, right? Basically, the leading terms come from, let's say, you integrate over all frequencies.
You can do this exactly.
Right? And then basically, you take some order of limits in momenta to get the leading term. So my point is that when t perp is much smaller than the external momentum in frequency, so this energy scale, that means that basically, the leading term comes from the external momentum in frequency enters an infrared cutoff in these integrals. So my point is that when t perp is much smaller than this infrared cutoff, t perp doesn't do anything, because basically it will give you it will give you subleading corrections. But things change if t perp is comparable to the external frequency momentum, because then t perp becomes the infrared cutoff itself, and then you get a crossover. So my argument is that if you're probing your experiment at energy scales which are much larger than t perp, right? T perp cannot affect the leading terms in the polarizability.
What is that? The number of n, the number of layers.
No, this is the order of the diagram.
N,
the order of the diagram. Okay. So in a sense, if the external momentum in frequency enter in those integrals as an infrared cutoff. Okay. So if t perp is much smaller than that infrared cutoff, t perp will only give you a subleading correction.
But then you get some feature in the optical response to t perp. Mm-hmm. If you have any layer, you have a replica at the n time t perp. So you have to wonder about the number of layers.
No, n is not number of layers.
Yeah, but if you have a number of layers, you have a replica or optical feature of t perp at the n t perp. It's not only you look at the response function. Mm-hmm. In the by layer, you have something at the t perp.
Yes.
And you have number of layers, you have a replica of this. So it's not true that you can forget if you are larger than t bar. You have to be larger than the number of layers times t bar.
Larger than the number of layers times t perp.
Yeah.
I don't follow.
For instance, in three layers, we have something at the, not the t bar, but the three t bar, something multiplied by the number of layers.
Well, if you're in graphite, which will have infinite number of layers, no, I disagree.
Yeah, so this is all very safe, right? Graphite looks 2D if you go far enough away from the direct point.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
If you're much harder than T-perp, the spectrum is pretty much identical, and polarization properties are not that different. It's not that. I disagree. So my argument is that So the physics. So the argument is that basically, if you are looking at energy scales which are much larger than T perp, basically external momentum and frequency, right? Then basically the polarization of graphite and graphene, they are approximately the same. Of course, there's this 1 over d factor here, which accounts for the fact that it's not a single layer. It's a stack of completely decoupled layers, right? Because you have to preserve the volume of the unit cell. Okay, so that's my claim, and that's the crucial argument that I will use to extract useful information from graphite and say something about a single freestanding layer of graphene. Okay,
that's ignoring correlations of electrons between different layers.
No, we're taking everything into account. All interactions between the layers are taken into account in this story.
RPA
correlations.
It's not RPA. This is beyond RPA.
The polarization function.
This is the proper polarization.
What Lina said is the polarization function. Even if you had, let's say, you had isolated sheets, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Then the polarization function of each sheet would depend on correlation between electrons in different layers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you're ignoring that.
No, I'm not.
So
this argument should, my statement is that this argument should be valid to all orders in perturbation theory. If I can repeat it now, or I can.
Are you claiming that the polarization function is the polarization function of isolated graphene sheets?
What I'm saying is that when the electronic hopping between the two layers, between.
The hopping effect is fine.
Is zero, then basically the electrons don't disperse along the C-axis direction. Mm-hmm. And so this, let's say this diagram here, these fermionic lines have no Kz dependence because there's no T perp is zero. The only place where Kz appears is here, right? But then since it's only here, you can integrate in Kz. And when you do that, you get 1 over Q, which is the Coulomb interaction in 2D.
Yeah, so I agree that it's going to be.
And this is valid for any order in perturbation.
Of Kz,
yeah.
That's okay, but it's actually would be different in principle. Although not within random phase approximation, which is probably fine for that.
But this is not RPA, right? This should hold for any order.
That it's independent of QZ, but not that it's independent of the presence of the other layers. That's not right.
No, but I'm not taking, this is 1 over Q squared. So you can generalize this, in fact, to the more general case where you have an infinite number of discrete layers. And then you use the form factors of discrete layers. You get 1 over Q the same way.
I'm not arguing with 1 over Q, but the numbers are actually dependent on the presence of other layers.
Well, what I'm saying is that this is the polarization of an infinite number of stacks which are coupled only by Coulomb. This is equal to an infinite number of layers which are completely decoupled. Yeah. Polarizability.
Because if you are physically considering them at different spatial heights, then you could have, let's say, 1 and 2 mm-hmm. coming in, mm-hmm. and then 1 and 2 coming out of
yes.
those lines. So
yes.
you throw these lines at 1 and the other 2 lines at 2 or 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. So that's the dependence on Kz implicitly, because it tells you which index of your layer, which depends on Kz, depends on the height.
Sure.
When you do the integral over Kz, mm-hmm. you're not summing only the internal line, you're presumably, the wavy line, mm-hmm. presumably summing also over the index of the propagator.
Yeah, I think that's what's missing is that, let's say, just take as an artificial model a case where there's no hopping between the layers, okay? Then there will be a set of polarization functions which are off diagonal in layer index, right? That there will be a response, even a proper polarization in mm-hmm. layer 1 mm-hmm. due to a density perturbation mm-hmm. potential in layer 2. Mm-hmm. That and those things are not present in in RPA, but they're not strictly zero, I don't think.
Well, this is a drag. This is a drag, this is a measurable drag.
For example, drag is one example of an effect, yeah.
So I think probably the basically, if you're assuming the only the steady case, then probably the his argument is right. But if you consider really dynamics, then all other higher order is
not even static, right? Yeah.
Dynamics and what?
No, I mean, for example, this Coulomb line, right? The inside the bubble.
If there's retardation, then I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
but
energy, then I cannot, I mean, your interpretation is not simply one of a choice, probably something different.
Right, so if there's retardation, I don't know. But I'm taking into account the dynamics of the fermions, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Arlen's argument is probably like only RPA. Then all diagonals probably not care, but if you consider the dynamic case, then...
Well, if you assume...
No, statically, there's some effect.
This is different things.
Yeah.
This is different things.
But it may not matter quantitatively all that much, but there certainly is an effect.
We can discuss that more, okay? I have to think more carefully. So, okay, so let me tell you what has been done. So this is the claim, okay? And basically with this claim, you can basically extract the susceptibility of a freestanding graphene out of the data from graphite, right? And the reason is very simple, because polarization is basically equal to the susceptibility, which is a sum over all bubbles, 1 plus V times chi, right? So if you claim that this is equal, you can relate this for graphite and graphene, which are the same apart from a factor of D, then you can basically relate the two susceptibilities, okay? And this is the expression that you get. But this F is this form factor that I was telling you about, which takes into account the discrete nature of the layers. Okay. So, okay, so we may ask if this seems to work. So this is what we did to check if this procedure works. Okay, so basically, we grabbed EELS data from André Geim. And so basically, the advantage of EELS is that you can do it on a single layer. Okay, so you can do it 2 layers, 5 layers, 10 layers. The disadvantage is that you cannot tune the momentum very well, although you have a very good frequency resolution. So basically, this is the spectral function for some momentum. Okay. So what we did is the following. We grabbed this EELS data for these 10 layers, which is graphite. Okay. We converted the data using that formula that I showed you. And then we compare with the EELS data of the same experiment for the single layer. And we see if the two curves match. Okay. So you can see these curves are very different. Okay. These peaks here are what people call plasmons in graphite language. So there's a big redshift of spectral weight and all other features. So if this formula works, then you should be able to make these curves, basically collapse this curve into this one, but just by applying that formula.
What is notation? L is layers?
Layers, yeah, number of layers. So this is like graphite, and this is graphene. Okay. So yeah, so these peaks here are these pi band transitions and sigma band transitions, which are pretty high energy. Okay, so this is so this is what we get. Okay, so this curve here in green is the single layer EELS data of graphene. Okay, and this blue here is basically the graphite EELS converted by that formula. Okay, and this is the same thing that we did, but using instead of EELS, we used ab initio. Basically, we grab ab initio for graphite, which is this green curve here, okay? And then we convert this curve using that formula, and then it gives you this blue curve, okay? And the red one is the graphene computed by ab initio.
And the Q that you use is a fit?
Yeah, the Q is a fit. Basically, we use the X-ray data to fit the graphite curve for use to know what's the Q they have. And with that fitting parameter, we get this curve, okay? So it seems to work very well. In ab initio, there is this little bump here in the ab initio curve for graphene. But this is not present in the EELS data. So this could be artifact of ab initio. We don't know. Okay, this little bump here. That's the only disagreement in the ab initio case.
On the x-axis, there is also the EV.
Sorry?
On the x-axis, measuring EV.
TV.
Yeah.
You can see.
You can see it. Yeah.
Does it work also on nuclear energy? For instance, there are data by Italians in the close to Bano singularity for 1 to 6 layer. So if you apply that, does it work? Is it a lower energy?
Yeah, it seems to work. Yeah, it's
the lower energy. So
yeah, up to I think they went up down to I mean the fitting is not perfect here, but
I'm talking about the 2 dB.
Uh-huh.
Can you apply that?
Yeah, sure. Well, the thing is you should not get too close to T perp because then this formula breaks down. Right, so you have to be careful with your energy scales. If you get too close to T perp, then you have a crossover, and then this relation falls apart. Right, but 2 eV should be good.
But you didn't check.
With the EELs, I think it stops about here. But we had the ab initio. No, yeah.
There are data by 20 eyes.
Uh-huh.
In the region of Banach singularity, that's different number layer.
The Van't Hoff singularity is about, you mean the M point? You mean the M point?
Yeah, no, the Q EV, something like that. I mean, the Van't Hoff singularity.
Yeah, this is about, I mean, the subtraction of the background here is a bit, right? This is negative, right?
So
the EELS data in that region is not great, right?
Just one question, actually the peak around the 15 electron volt, right, is coming from the sigma band transition.
Yes, yes.
But your calculation is more like pi band approximation, right, or the epsilon or pi, whatever.
No, these transitions are this. So then graphite.
Sigma band transitions give a high end peak,
yes,
15 electron volt.
Yeah, but this is graphite.
Graphite, but your formalism is all based on the pi band approximation, right?
No, this includes everything. This includes everything.
Okay, so your calculation is, I mean, the fitting though with the experimentation, your calculation is also including the sigma band.
Everything, whatever is the band structure. Okay. The only assumption is that graphite and graphene have the same single particle spectrum. So whatever it is, yes.
There is one approximation, I think, that which is ignoring the lattice structure. Which even though
in plane, or
yes,
okay,
even though your
yes.
Q is small,
yes, yes,
you get to this high energies.
Yeah, yeah, but then it's much more complicated,
mm-hmm.
Right? Yes. So okay, so this is the data that I'm going to show you here, the X-ray experiment that Peter did. This is actually an impressive experiment because you see he almost completely scanned the entire phase space. So he went in momentum up to 8 inverse angstroms. 8 inverse angstroms is like 6 Brillouin zones.
Right. This is a lot.
And he went from down to, let's say, order of of hundreds of millielectron volts up to 160 eV. So he gets beyond the Compton scattering regime. So this is a humongous amount of data. It took him like 2 years to do this experiment. And he measured all these different angles, right? So it's like really mapping the entire phase space. So when you do X-rays, in general, the intensity of the peaks or the data that you get is completely meaningless, per se. What you have to do is to calibrate the data, right? Because they don't know what that intensity means. And the calibration of the data is done by enforcing the F-sum rule. This is what all X scatterers do, okay? So basically, you basically multiply the overall intensity by a number in a way that the F-sum rule is enforced. Okay, and here he did that. Basically, he applied a single calibration for all data points to make it consistent. Okay, and it works pretty well. But what is interesting here is that once you calibrate your data for a graphite and you convert the data for a graphene, the converted data also satisfies the epsilon rule, which is nice because it means that you are not wasting spectral weight or it's conserving spectral weight, which is good. Okay. So the converted data satisfies the epsilon rule, so you don't have to do anything else with the data once you calibrate it once. So, okay, so these are these features I was telling you about. These peaks here for given momenta are basically these processes, right, which I was telling you about. People call them plasmons, okay? So, okay, with all this information, you can basically extract the response function for a graphene, suspended graphene. Okay, and this is the plot, which is the important one, which is basically where you divide alpha, which is 2.2, you divide it by the dynamical dielectric function, okay, using this converted data measured from graphite. So this is the absolute value. Okay, so this line here is a guide to the eye. So the Van Hoff is here, 0.5. Inverse angstrom. So beyond here, there's no Dirac cone anymore. So the Dirac cone is about here. And this is the phase, okay, because this is a complex quantity. So, okay. So this is the region where you talk about Dirac fermions, right? And so there are many interesting features here. One is in the static limit, you see that this number here is of the order of 0.13, which is about 1 over 7. Okay, but when you cross this region here, it jumps. It goes to 0.39, so that corresponds to epsilon of this is alpha, jumps by a factor of 3. And when it gets here, so it gets alpha, it's like 2.6, so it's even bigger than 2.2. Okay, so getting to the optical regime, alpha can be really large. Okay. Depending where you are in the phase space, the dressed alpha can be quite different. Okay. So perhaps depending on the kind of experiment you're interested, right, interactions can be more or less effective, right? So the one big question is, okay, so this is the static limit where you get the small number for finite momentum, and the question is if you have the right to extrapolate this data to lower momentum, okay, and say that this is the long way. Up to a certain length scale, of course, but where logs, before logs becoming important, if this is the correct dielectric screening of the system at long wavelengths before logs become important and eventually kill interactions.
So this is, just to be clear, I'm not sure, this is completely different from what people normally talk about as alpha, right?
Yeah. So. It's not a universal number. It's not. It's a function. Right, it's not just a number that you plug in, right? You have to integrate the dynamical structure of this function, and right. So
it's zero frequency growth.
What?
This is zero frequency.
Well, here it's zero frequency, right? Here it's finite frequency, right? And alpha and the dressed alpha can be huge, right? It's 2.6. It's even larger than 2.2. Because this is where you have the plasmon, right? The plasmon is like a zero of the dielectric function, so it can enhance interactions. Okay?
Was so some argument, sorry, I just couldn't. There wasn't some argument from your previous expression that we don't have the right to extract.
No. The question is if we do or if we do not. And I'm going to argue that we do. Okay? So the argument is that if the physics here is dominated by Dirac fermions, right? Then once you have crossed the Van Hoff in direction to the Dirac point, you have, in a sense, exhausted all the energy scales in the problem. So nothing else can happen, right? Pi has to be linear in Q, right? So one thing you can do is basically to look for the behavior, the static behavior of the susceptibility. So this is for graphene, the red points, and this is for graphite, okay? And then you see that the susceptibility of graphite, basically divided by Q, saturates, whereas in graphene, it's almost linear. So the way you understand this is that chi, right, which is pi divided by 1 minus V pi. So if pi is linear, right, so this is like Q divided by 1 minus VQ. So if V is 1 over Q, this is a constant, so pi, chi is linear too, provided that pi is linear, right? But if V is 1 over Q square, then basically chi goes like Q square, right? And the dielectric function goes like 1 over Q, so it increases, okay? And this is about more or less what you have here, right? Okay, we just have two data points here. It's actually very hard to get more data points with this current setup. right? And you can may question how reliable is this extrapolation, right? But actually, this is a little bit better than 2 points because you see, this is a saturation, and you're dividing this by 1 over q. So it means that the linear coefficient of pi is approximately 0, right? So this guy here is extrapolating to 0, as you would expect for Dirac fermions at q equals 0, right? But to convince ourselves that the physics here is indeed dominated by Dirac fermions, what we did is the following. We looked at these two data points, and we looked at the frequency dependence of the imaginary parts of pi and chi for these two values of q. And then we compare with what you would expect for non-interacting Dirac fermions.
Okay.
So this is how it looks. So this is the q values for those two data points. Okay. And then we compare the data with the solid curves, which is what you would expect in the imaginary part of chi for non-interacting Dirac fermions. So you see there's some similarity in the shoulder, but things get a little bit more clear when you compute, instead of chi, you compute pi, okay, which is this. So this curve in solid line is the optical edge of absorption for non-interacting Dirac fermions, right? And what it seems here is that this edge is somehow redshifted by a finite amount of energy, both for these two different data points, right? It's the same trend. And the way we interpreted this is that these are excitonic effects in graphene, okay? So basically, we interpret this as these states being actually bound states formed by particle hole pairs. And these states live in the optical gap of the particle hole continuum, which is about here. And these guys are a bit fat, so there is decay, okay? And somehow this agrees with a recent ab initio calculation that was done by Steve Louis, where basically he solves the Betasol-Peter equation, and he gets the same redshift that we've observed here. Right, and he claims also this to be an indication of excitonic effect. There are other experimental indications of excitons in graphene by experiments of Tony Hines. Okay, so what it looks from this data, if the analysis is sound, is that simple RPA is not enough to describe the polarizability of graphene. You need particle hole channels to be included there too, and they make the vacuum more polarizable. Right. So this is something else we did, is basically with all this information about pi and chi, you can simply compute the total amount of charge which would be accumulated around a test charge if you put it there, assuming linear response, right? You can just compute that. And when we do that, then we get this number here, which is a net charge, right? So basically, this is the accumulated charge. If you integrate the charge up to a certain radius as it evolves with distance, and basically it saturates to a number, and basically you can get a dielectric constant from that. And that number agrees, of course it should, because this calculation relies on the assumption that you can extrapolate the pi data linearly, right, of those two last data points. So to make long story short, this the number that we get for static polarization is a number of the order of 10, right? So this is a very small fraction of the initial charge you had. So this indicates substantial screening. Okay. I would just like to make a brief comment about other experiments. I guess you all know about this experiment of Michael Feuerherr, where basically he put a lot of atoms in graphene, and basically he sees the mobility changing, Coulomb impurities, right? And my claim is that this experiment is not necessarily inconsistent with us, and also with this other experiment of André Geim, where basically he sees that if he changes the dielectric constant of substrates, mobility doesn't change much. And my claim is that if you add more disorder, it's not the long-range piece of the Coulomb interaction which is affecting mobility. It could be the short-range piece of the Coulomb interaction which is doing that. Okay, so fine, the mobility is changing, but...
Just as a remark that you can leave aside, but the screening effect is completely different physics from the screening effect you're talking about. Because you're talking, I mean, in Peter's experiment, he's looking at omega much bigger than EF. And this is omega much smaller than EF, screening of static impurities.
No. You can talk about the static properties, because basically you get the imaginary part, you can chromosynchronize. So,
yeah, so what I'm saying is these systems that mm-hmm. Michael Fuhrer looks at, for example.
Yes, it's a static response that matters.
Yes, but it's they're dope systems with carriers.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And the limit omega goes to zero when you have carriers, mm-hmm. then EF becomes an important quantity. And he's looking in the limit where omega is much less than EF. The screening is occurring, you know, by the impurities.
Right.
Whereas what Peter's looking at in his experiment is some kind of screening effect due to interband polarization.
Let's talk about length scales, right? So so this effect that we got extends up to like 15 angstroms. KF would give you a length scale of hundreds of angstroms, I think. Right? So, right? Is that what you mean?
I'm saying that the screening of that's relevant for external charges mm-hmm. in a system with carriers. Mm-hmm. The screening length is of order the Fermi wavelength, as you say, right? So if you looked at it in space, maybe you would see that it's hundreds of angstroms. But it's completely different physics that's important for screening these carriers.
Oh no, this is not metallic screening. This is dielectric screening, right?
In Peter's experiment.
Yeah, it's dielectric screening. It has nothing to do with KF.
Well, you can call it dielectric-like screening, if you like.
Yeah.
But it's interband screening.
Yes, it has nothing to do with KF.
Yeah.
KF is very far away. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with that.
If I understand, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. so what we're doing is we're using Cramer's theorem.
Mm-hmm.
So the claim is, if I say correctly, that using omegas, which are electron volts, and Cramer's theorem, we make conclusions about omega equal to zero.
Omega equals zero in a non-doped system, right? The physics completely changes when in graphite. The physics would completely change when you get to the EF of graphite.
Sure.
And you would get metallic screen.
Sure, sure.
So right. He's arguing that the data sees something similar to actually looking at the polarization in a neutral graphene sheet.
But this is the length scales are very
compared to VQ. Right.
These oscillations are not Friedel oscillations. They're related to other, completely other.
Absolutely, they're not.
Okay.
So this is Peter's experiment is on what it tells you something, I believe, about what the polarization would look like in a neutral graphene sheet
mm-hmm.
At a frequency omega that's small compared to VQ.
Right.
And he finds that at an energy of half the Van Hove energy, mm-hmm. it's bigger than you would expect.
Right. And KF would start to become important if the length scale becomes comparable to this.
Yes, but all I'm saying is that the experiment by Fuhrer that you're comparing with,
what's
all of that physics is screening by carriers.
What's the KF there, you know?
It doesn't matter what it is. I think the Coulomb interactions completely screened. So
after a certain length scale, which is 1 over KF.
It goes like 1 over Q, if you like, in that case.
Yeah.
In your case, it goes to a constant.
Sure, sure. But that's metallic screening, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, I mean, the argument is that physics is completely different, but
yeah.
It's the same analytic function. And by magic of analytic functions, you don't need to know physics. You do math.
It depends what you're trying to conclude.
Yeah, and automatically, this procedure gives you correct result.
For what?
So knowing a response at high omega, you have to know the null interval, right?
What? That's not.
You're doing Cramer's chronic.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. In the Cramer's chronic, some magic thing. You don't need to think. You don't need to know physics. If you have the data for
right.
the imaginary part of, you can convert to real by simple integration.
Right, so he's doing
sure,
know,
but that's
all of
comes from the analytic structure of
right.
All
the
of
physics
the
measure, changes,
you know,
but this magic procedure just warps. Right?
That's causality or whatever, right?
Yeah. But all of the measurements are at high frequencies.
I know.
And It doesn't tell you actually anything about what's going on.
Okay, let me, you said the frequency can be as low as fraction of EV, is that right?
They can go up to, yeah, fraction of EV.
So, okay, so from fraction, lowest frequency to fraction.
And the Fermi energy of graphite is, Millie's not here, but I think it's it's like 10 MeV or something like that. Right, so if you actually went to 10 MeV in graphite, you'd see something completely different. You wouldn't see decoupled sheets, you'd see 3D metal. So I think the thing you can conclude from this measurement about graphite is that the polarization function for omega small compared to VQ is bigger than you would expect from the Dirac model.
Omega smaller than VQ, okay.
And actually the measurement is at a frequency which is only a half or so of the Van Hove singularity frequency. But it certainly says that what you get there is not what you expect from the Dirac model. You get a bigger polarization function than you would expect.
Yes, that's the claim that RPA is probably insufficient.
Well, you know, it could be RPA. I think it's very likely also band structure effects are important.
Any?
That I'm not sure, because the Van Hove transition, for instance, they contribute to the polarizability like Q squared over some energy.
Yes, gets, right.
And then you divide it by, in two dimensions, you divide it by Q.
Yeah.
So it will not give a contribution.
Yeah. But, you know, Q squared over Q at a finite Q can still be big. But, you know, it's the fact that
but
strictly you have,
speaking, if you go to the Dirac point, that contribution will be fine.
You know, I think people have concluded, I think this is another issue we could discuss, Oscar's a part of this a little bit, but if you take a Dirac model, there are two types of effects that influence pi. There are self-energy effects that are the velocity enhancements that make pi smaller, and there are excitonic effects that make pi bigger. And I think most people have concluded that the velocity effects dominate, so I think that the general feeling is that beyond RPA corrections to the polarization function of a single graphene sheet make the interband polarization smaller and not larger. Could be that conclusion is wrong, but when you talk about whether interband effects, you know, what I'm saying is I'm not really convinced that they're really in a limit where it's the mathematical 1 over Q, coefficient of Q in the polarization function in the limit Q goes to 0 that's being picked off in the experiment. They're looking at pi of Q over Q at some finite Q, which is not that far from the Van Hove. Band structure effects, I think, can play a big role in this observation.
My claim is if the physics is dominated by Dirac fermions there, then that you should have the right to extrapolate that behavior to lower momentum.
Absolutely, I agree with you.
Right. So that's the claim. Mm-hmm. And to convince ourselves, we did some analysis in frequency, which you can believe or not, right? Or so that's our claim. But my point is that the high frequency data that you collect in the imaginary part of the susceptibility contains a lot of information about the static response of the system. Okay, to length scales which are much smaller than T perp divided by VF, one over that. Right? So, so there's the plasmaron experiment. I don't think this is contradictory necessarily with the plasmaron, because in the region where plasmarons or plasmons should be important, it's pretty much high frequency. Right, and there the screening is very small. So the fact that we see a lot of screening in a static regime is not necessarily contradictory to this picture, in my opinion.
Yeah. Again, these are completely different things because the energy scale of the solid plasma.
Yes, it's high frequency where interactions can be quite strong.
No, I was going to say the energy scale is EF, the Fermi energy, and whereas this other phenomena, you're always implicitly assuming that you're in the regime omega much bigger than omega F, where it doesn't matter if you have carriers or not.
Sure. When you enter at energy scales smaller than EF, then you have a crossover and things become metallic.
That's what I mean. Eli will talk more about these next week. But
okay. Yeah.
Energy scales affect the energy.
Okay. And also there is the Shubnikov-Haas experiment done by Andre Geim. Basically, there maybe he should give some talk about this here.
I can talk about this.
Yeah, you can talk about it too.
Since you did it.
Even better.
I don't agree with that statement that alpha, the feeling is alpha equal to 0.5.
Right.
Alpha is actually 2.4 or 2.7, I don't remember. And then it's getting screened.
Sure. But that's
1 over n. And
right. But okay, but this alpha is this alpha star.
The alpha using the feeling is right. 2.4.
Right, but what is alpha divided by? My point is.
In that fitting, you cannot even define epsilon.
Exactly.
It's a running.
Exactly. So, but there's a claim in the paper about some effective alpha being 0.5. And my point is that this is a. You cannot even fit the curves with that, as you just said, right?
These are boron nitride?
No, it's
suspended.
Okay.
So there is no intrinsic that static dielectric constant
right.
into the field.
Right.
That's for sure.
Okay.
There's like a running dielectric
right.
constant which appears in
right.
the normalization
perfect.
Process because it's RPA, it's not just pure
right.
particle.
And my point, yeah. And my point is that even with the running thing, you cannot perfectly fit the curve. There's qualitative agreement, right? It's not quantitative agreement.
But that's
you agree?
Typical of any logarithmic approach. I mean, you're never guaranteed. You depend. I mean, there are pre-factors.
Right.
So,
so my point is that I don't doubt this is the log that people are talking about. But my claim is that I'm not convinced that RPA is enough to describe this data quantitatively.
But I mean, any logarithm, any RG approach will never be able to tell you what the prefactors are. So if you want the two decimal digits, you cannot expect them.
So right. are you saying it depends when you fit it from where you start the
exactly.
RG flow?
I mean, there is always some uncertainty.
Yeah.
Where
so let's ask it this way. Again, I would say this is not the same thing that's measured in Peter's experiment, but let's say you started the RG flow at a few EV, which people often kind of implicitly, what the Dirac model breaks down. Then what starting value of alpha would you have to use?
2.4.
Okay, right, just what you'd expect. Which is not in contradiction with Peter's measurement at all.
No. So in a sense, this effective, which incorrect, but somehow effective alpha is in between the range.
But if you believe in that alpha, that would imply an epsilon, which is not 14.
No, but that's my point. When you compute the self-energy, you have to integrate over the entire frequency range, right? In metals, you just stick the static one because it doesn't make a difference. But in graphene, there's no reason to believe that's true. You have to really integrate the entire function. In a sense, it's like averaging, right, in the entire frequency domain. So the fact that you get a number which is in between 2.2 and 1 over 7 is fine.
Yeah, but most of the action, if you look at the figure, it's at very, very low densities, which means very, very low infrared cutoffs. So the bulk of the renormalization, you only find it when you go to really millivolts or something like that.
Right. So that's really hard to get those logs, right?
So I would like to just reiterate what Alan said, because I agree with it. I think the question which we can ask and we can all agree on is, what is alpha at a particular energy scale? Less than, but both less than where extra terms apart from linear dispersion kick in.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we fix the scale to be whatever, 1 eV, then we can say, what is alpha at 1 eV?
Mm-hmm.
We seem to all, well, at least we seem to agree that it's of order 2.2, maybe a little bit more. And of course, it will shrink if you are below the critical alpha.
Right.
So that number would be 2.2 then, as defined at that particular energy scale.
Assuming that epsilon is 1,
right? Yeah. So it's consistent with, but now that says is that there's no dielectric screening. It's not the same thing as Peter Abamonte measured.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Abamonte measured, in effect, the limit of pi over q, let's say, at small omega. It's not really omega zero, but let's say small omega.
Well, he measured for all omegas, right? I mean,
let's say.
And high omegas, too.
He measured pi over q at some pretty small q, and it's bigger than you would expect.
Right.
And it's not related to that in any direct way.
When you do this kind of calculation, you have to use alpha and integrate over all omegas, right?
It's just
let's say you're doing perturbation theory using the alpha, the dressed alpha, like screened interactions, and let's assume that this is a controllable expansion. Let's assume that, right? Then you just have to do the first order correction in the self energy. And you compute the dressed interaction using.
So most of this, quantitatively, what's seen in an experiment doesn't depend on screening at all, right? Screening plays a little bit of a role.
But that's what we tried at first, to use some static dielectric constant.
Yeah.
No, that's important. You have like a dielectric constant which is going towards one at the lowest densities, which is another way of saying that alpha is going to zero, and then there's no spinning anymore.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So at the lowest densities, the enhancement of the velocity is smaller than.
Right.
So some part of this curve is influenced by by screening effects, but a large part of it is not. Mm-hmm. And it's not the same thing.
Right. Eventually, screening becomes less and less important as you get closer to the direct point. That's true. The question is, what is the initial alpha, right, that you will start doing your RG?
I don't remember the figures in the paper, but we have it. You can fit the high density part of the reduction in the Fermi velocity by some epsilon of order 4. But if you go to low density, mm-hmm. that epsilon, that fit, if you just insist in a single law, mm-hmm. the full RPA exchange current, if you insist in a single law, that epsilon has gone down to 2 more or less, at the very end of those curves. So if you want to use some epsilon, the best thing for you to do is to make it density dependent.
But then RPA starts to become good, you see? So
RPA in which sense?
Well, this RG calculation is based on RPA.
And dot graphing is your number.
Sure, but if alpha is large, RPA is not justified, right? If alpha is small, then RPA is good. So, and then your calculation should become better and better as alpha becomes smaller.
I'm not sure. By that time, you have another alpha, which depends on a new Fermi velocity. If you insist in RPA using the typical value for the Fermi velocity, 10 to the 6 meters per second, you may get a reasonable fit at high densities, but it's not that good by any means at low densities.
Okay. And what we believe is that you really have, in fact, we have indication of excitonic effects, which could be helping to make the system more polarizable. So,
strictly speaking, for experiments like these, mm-hmm. Transitions, interband transitions mm-hmm. in the sigma bands mm-hmm. or between Van Hoff singularities mm-hmm. in the pi bands mm-hmm. will not contribute.
Well, but you cannot get a quantitative fit, right? So.
But that's typical of any renormalization loop analysis. You cannot expect, maybe you can go to 5 loops and then you can fit everything, but that's. I don't think. It's worth taking all the effort. But from a single loop calculation or the first order in a 1 over n expansion, which is what we did, we'll never be able to get 2 decimal digits.
Right. So, yeah. So.
But the fact that the whole thing is changing by a factor of almost 3, uh-huh. and you can fit it in a reasonable way.
Okay. So, So our claim is that we believe that you have to go beyond RPA to describe the polarization properties of graphene. That's
and
what
and
we.
It should also be done 1 over n expansion if you can.
Sure. The problem is very hard to do these calculations. So that's why I think this experiment is useful to indicate something, right? So, yeah, and finally, of course, the fact that the system could be strongly polarizable is not contradictory also with the existence of the fractional quantum Hall effect. Because at wavelengths which are longer than the cyclotronic wavelength, basically the kinetic energy becomes quenched in the Landau levels. So in a sense, the system becomes more strongly interacting again. Okay, because it's like closer to being a gapped state, in a sense.
Yeah, so, Brudog, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but this epsilon that you identified,
yes,
wouldn't be, you know, something that would tell you very much about the strength of the fractional quantum Hall effect. It's not, you can't just take this thing that you're defining as effective epsilon.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's not contradictory with that.
Yeah, it's completely unrelated.
Yeah, exactly. So this is not a contradiction.
Yeah,
good.
I agree with that.
So that's it. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And let me apologize for talking so much, but Bruno and I have had this conversation before.
Sure.
So.
Okay. So this is a discussion. So yeah.
Is it possible to do this small cube?
He's trying to do that now. It's a completely different setup because it's tough. We use X-rays for that. But
there is a minimum cube because you have q pair for gamma 1.
Yeah, we cannot go to too low q. But at least we want to get more data points in the region where it's safe to get better statistics.
Is the type of staking for these material samples known?
He did it in two kinds of samples. He did it in single crystal samples and also in HOPG. So HOPG is like it's random,
yeah.
Right? So basically, when you do it in HOPG, you basically lose information about orientation. Right.
Right. But single crystal is it
AB. Yes. And we get the same things. Of course, if you want to make nice plots of the induced density with the features that depends on orientation, then you have to do it on a single crystal. But the numbers are comparable.
Something that is not clear to me under this discussion. So this epsilon that we supposedly will put into the alpha will also depend on the q and omega, right?
Yes. So if you want to do completely consistent, you have to stick the whole thing.
So your prediction is that epsilon should be of the order of tensor at which omega.
That's the static limit. Yeah, omega equals zero, which is the case where you have Coulomb impurities. But when you start talking about renormalization of the spectrum, you have to integrate over the entire thing. And then this number changes a lot, right? So it's more complicated than that. It's not a universal number you just put it there.
I'm not fairly sure that such a large value of epsilon is at all compatible with the previous experiment. The one
right. Right, so which experiments?
The ones that they should involve the measurement of the renormalization of the thermodynamics. I think if at some energy scale epsilon were so large, you will see nothing.
It's large in a particular region, but if you cross this line here, where's that?
What you're saying is that if it really persisted down to zero q, very small q, then it would be inconsistent with the velocity measurement.
There would be basically no renormalization of the velocity.
And so, the experimental observation is that there's more polarization than you would expect in the regime of this frequency. Maybe another way out is that
we don't know what happens. Suppose this is true and you are here, right? Maybe it jumps a lot, even when you are at very very low q. We don't know.
But now that you mentioned the plasmaron experiments, the velocity renormalization experiments are quite consistent with the value of alpha you have needed, you have used to fit this experiment. So it looks as if alpha, at least for these particular experiments, doesn't change too much from experiment to experiment.
One has to test it, right? And grab the entire thing and do calculations to see how much these experiments agree with each other. We don't know.
And the, you know, so what I was going to say, one possibility is that you're starting to see that it's a metal. So certainly the fact that, it, you know, graphite is a metal means that when you go to small enough Q, you get a lot more polarizability than you would get for a bunch of deep metal direct systems.
Yes.
So
yes.
Maybe that's what's making the polarizability. The actual measured polarizability is, you know, about twice as big as you would naively expect, right? I think that's
right. Yeah,
that's
from RPA, yes.
And so maybe there's some little tail, small tail of the extremely small, large polarizability that you get from graphite Fermi surfaces is starting to have an impact.
We need more data to make it sure. Yes. But what this suggests is that it's, the static one is a number of the order of 10. We have large error bars because we get a 5% error bar in the data because of this calibration business.
Mm-hmm.
But when you compute dielectric functions, right, basically you have small denominators, so these error bars can be big. Right? So it's a number between 8 and 45, right?
I asked before, so one cannot put the frequency to zero, right? Because one gets the Fermi energy of something.
Well, this is extrapolating the data, right? In the region, from the region where it's the spectrum is dominated by Dirac fermions. So this is what you would get if you were in graphene, right? So this is an extrapolation based
but
on the
energy is fine, right? It's sitting somewhere there, right?
Sure, but that's why we cannot go there, because these relationships will be completely invalid, right? But the argument is the physics here is dominated by Dirac fermions, then you know what should happen next.
Right.
So yeah, and the data seems consistent with that. We see the correct scaling in that region. So, yeah.
I have a question for Paco, if I may say. So that fit with the velocities down that you at some high density, you take the alpha in vacuum, right? So you take 2.2 and then let it run down, right?
And actually at a lower velocity, because it was measured way back in the magnitude of the Fermi velocity is not 10 to the 6 meters per second, it's 0.8.
Right.
So
alpha is a little bit higher to start with, right?
It's high energy, which was a bit less than 1, about 1 eV, and the lower velocity, like 0.8.
Right.
But those are, of course, adjustable parameters. That's why I emphasize that you cannot expect a quantitative agreement in full with the experimental data.
Right.
That's not what the RT is for.
Right.
Come on. Questions or discussions?
Can we make a summary of all that? I mean,
what we're saying is that the system is more polarizable, and therefore that might explain why it was so hard to see these logs. Because you have a small number, right? I mean, it's more complicated than that, but you have something small conspiring against your log. So you have to get really close to your Dirac points to see the physics emerging. So the Manchester experiment seems to be the first one to see that physics happening. It would also, in my opinion, but you seem to disagree. You think the physics maybe we can discuss that in more detail about the Michael Feuerherr's experiment. I would like to understand that your argument a bit better. And this is, in a sense, not contradictory in principle with many other experiments which are in the market.
The point, why I find this attractive, although many people are skeptical about it, is that that would explain the success of perturbation theory in graphene, which is a real success, and is absolutely not justified if the alpha is 1.4.
You would disagree.
I think the one over N expansion, N is 4, and people in high energy do such expansion for N equal 3. So it's reliable. It's no longer an expansion in alpha.
Yeah, well, but
we can discuss, but that's, I think, this is something else.
Another thing I wanted to say, that there is still a puzzle here, and that if there were different estimates for the acetonic transition, as I was mentioning, and quite a few of them were for alpha and 1. And clearly, that's out of the question now, because by the time the measurements at the lowest densities look at the Fermi velocity, alpha is less than 1. And there's no acetonic transition, so it will never happen, given the experiment that's
the acetonic condensation, we mean, the gap.
So which is the actual critical value of alpha in order to have an acetonic condensation? Because according to Monte Carlo and so on, alpha was supposed to be of order 1 and could be realizable in suspended time.
So I think that quantum Monte Carlo calculation will, right, that person from BU was telling us,
right,
might shed some light on that. He was telling us that there is some neat constellation that solves the sine problem per se for the honeycomb lattice.
No, it's half filled.
Yeah, at half filling. At half filling. So yeah, I think if you have a chance to talk to him about this.
Although it'll be, you know, if there, let's say, we know from this velocity experiments that the gap, if it is present, is less than 100 micro EV, right?
No, but it is worse than that, because at low scales, the alpha has already gone down by or.
Yeah, but let's say, so you know in a suspended sample that the bare alpha is around what you would expect, right? At a 1 EV starting point, and so for graphene, if that's you know, if the real, we know experimentally the real gap, if there is one, is less than 100 micro EVs, and I think that's impossible numerically if you start from a model that has states a bandwidth of 10 EV or something, right? That's what, how many orders of magnitude? 100, 10, 4, 5, that's way too many. But yeah, they can bump up E squared, of course. They can make the bare alpha in their calculation very large, and that would be useful. Take away spin, see what that does. I think that would be very interesting calculations. Yeah. We still don't know, of course, that there isn't a gap of a nano EV, right? It's possible.
Yeah, that's possible.
Oh, there is the king and the lioness.
Oh, yes.
There's that match, definitely. We don't know what that one is, right? That's bigger than the
micro EV.
Normalization. What?
According to Kane and Mel, it's enhanced by this law.
Yes, yes, to milli EV, right?
According to within the window that is reachable by those experiments, because this is like the hunting of the Higgs, and hunting of the dark in the thing is really the window is narrowing very much.
Well, yeah. Well, we know that the enhanced gap is less than 100 micro EV, so.
In the plasma around experiments, so this EF is very high, right? So this alpha that you extract for the fit, it's very screened alpha, right?
So the calculation is, you know, sort of assumes a bare alpha, which in the case of that experiment is influenced by substrate, you know, what happens is that when you have carriers, most of the physics on the energy scale of the Fermi energy is determined by intra-band physics, which is simply not there in the on-dope system.
Right.
So this is kind of unrelated to the question of what happens in an on-dope system.
Well, I think it's a matter of length scales.
Length scale is
my point is, for example, when you look for, let's say, static response, right? So physically what happens is you have these local effects, right? And then at some length scales, which are of the order of 1 over kF, then you would start getting metallic screen.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. Then you might still be able to look at intrinsic on-dope physics on short enough length scales.
Yes.
It doesn't matter that the carriers are there, but that our understanding of that plasmaron feature is that it's it has an energy scale of the Fermi energy. So you wouldn't it's not there. It goes away, and you take away the carriers.
Okay. Any more comments, discussions? I guess we maybe can stop here.
Thank you very much.